Well, good afternoon again. The roulette with the microphone has come down this way today, so to hell with it, with all technology. If you can't hear me at the back at any point, just shout out and I'll speak louder, okay? Is this okay for you at this volume? Okay, fine. Maybe we don't need that rubbish anyway. I can't stand it. Okay, we're going to start on our penultimate of two topics that are left over for this course, for this thread of the course, rather. And we're going to look at a couple of fundamental algorithms on graphs, and we'll look at some consequences of one of them next time. So let's begin with that. So we're going to look at, let's say, graphs. So first of all, let me just define what I mean by graph so that there are no misunderstandings. I expect you'll have seen a definition of a graph at some stage, but let's just make absolutely sure we're synchronized. So a graph is nothing other than two sets. The first set is a set of vertices. The second set is a set of pairs of vertices. End of definition. That is it. Okay. So formally, a graph consists of V and E. V is a set and E is a subset of V cross V. Remember, the Cartesian product of a set is just all pairs of objects from the set. Okay. That's the end of the definition of what is a graph. No more, no less. Okay. But we can make some more definitions related to it. If we have an edge E, so pairs are called edges. Okay. And if it's an edge UV, with the entries in that order, of course, then we say that the edge goes from vertex U to vertex V. It's a directed edge starting at U, ending at V. This is a purely convenient pictorial thought of what this pair means. An edge is simply a pair of vertices, but we can think of it as giving us a direction from the first to the second. Okay, a very conventional definition. Okay, we call an edge undirected, or the graph is undirected, precisely when, if there's an edge going from U to V, then there is also an edge going from V to U. Okay, so they always come in pairs. Okay, we're not saying there is always an edge between pairs of vertices. Of course, we just say if there happens to be one, then there's one in the other direction. So you might as well think of it as just being an undirected, an unordered pair of vertices that corresponds to an edge without a direction. You can go either way. Clear? Okay. Graphs will be directed unless we explicitly say they are undirected. Okay. So our algorithms will always be by default on directed graphs. They will apply, of course, to undirected ones, simply because an undirected graph is just a very special kind of directed one. So, and the way to think of graphs is directed edges correspond to arrows between vertices, undirected graphs, the edges correspond to lines between vertices. But that's just a very nice, convenient way of thinking about graphs. We will assume for our purposes that V is finite. We can define infinite graphs, and they're very useful objects to look at. You can even do algorithms on infinite graphs, but we shan't address that in this pair of lectures for obvious reasons, okay? And so if V is finite, then necessarily E is going to be finite, because E is a subset of pairs of vertices. If there's only finitely many vertices, there are only finitely many pairs of vertices. So that's pretty obvious. Note that this definition does not allow multiple edges. If you met graphs elsewhere, you might have met a definition that allows more than two edges between a pair of vertices. Since we've defined the edges to be a set, and the set has no multiples in it, that means that either there is an edge or there isn't an edge. There isn't a notion of there are two edges, three edges going between the same pair of vertices. Okay. If you want to allow multigraphs, as they're called, then your edges form what's called a multiset, not a set. But I'm defining them to be a set, which is the standard definition. So let's just look at an example of a directed graph. Formally speaking, okay, it consists of the vertices V, edges E. V is the set consisting of the numbers 0 up to 6. E is the set of all those pairs. Strictly speaking, I've now told you all there is to be said about this graph, and you now know it fully. But the human brain is not terribly good at taking this information in very well and very quickly, so it's happier with pictures. So we can draw a picture of it in a conventional manner. we just draw vertices as blobs with the vertex labeling the appropriate blob, and then edges as arrows between the appropriate blobs. Okay, I stress this is not the graph. Okay, it's simply a representation of the graph. We could draw any number of representations of the same graph. The graph is this object here. There's only one of it. It's that object there. But this is a very nice way of thinking about it. You know, you can see it's not the graph because I could move this to over here, just dragging all the edges with it. It's the same graph, but it's not the same diagram. Right? Okay? But, you know, we often abuse language and say, consider this graph, meaning the underlying mathematical structure that it represents. Okay? And that's, it's an important difference to appreciate. Once you appreciate it, you don't need to worry about it ever again. But if you dismiss it as saying it's pedantic nonsense, you are wrong. Seriously wrong. Okay? So don't do it. Okay? Undirected graph, obviously, we don't show, you know, it would be silly to show, an edge from here to here and back the other way around as well. It just clutters up the diagram. You just draw a line without any arrows, and you know that means you can go either way. Okay? Now, very simple, obvious convention. Okay, examples of graphs. Graphs are so fundamental because we so often want to study structures consisting of objects and binary relations between the objects. In other words, pairs of objects. And that you can obviously represent by means of a graph. Here are some examples. A road map is, you can think of it as a graph, where edges represent streets and vertices intersections of streets. Okay, or if you like, for Edinburgh, you might take bus stops, and there's an edge from bus stop 1 to bus stop 2 if there's a bus that goes directly from 1 to 2, okay? And you know that with Edinburgh, that graph is now rather dynamic, changes from day to day. But at any given instance, there is a graph that represents the buses of Edinburgh, okay? Computer networks, again, you can take the vertices to represent computers, and they just represent a network connection between them, a direct connection. You know, that computer A can talk to computer B directly. The web, again, another obvious graph underlying that. You can take your vertices to be pages and edges to be direct links between pages. Okay. Page 1 to page 2. Or you might want to take your vertices to be websites, and then your edges will be just, if there's a link from any page of that site to any page of the other site, that gives you a high-level abstraction. It's a matter of what you want to model. Okay, there's no sort of moral law that says it's got to be this or that. You decide what you want to model, and now very often there is an underlying graph that will model that data. Okay, I remember once reading somebody's fourth year project where he spent about 10 or 15 pages marveling at how you often see graphs here, there, and everywhere. I thought, well, you know, this is just, you know, if you don't know this by now, where were you, you know, until fourth year? You know, basically graphs, you can find them everywhere. Okay? Take the room consisting of all the people in this room. That's the vertices, so each of you is a vertex. And there's an edge if person one is a friend of person two. Something like that, okay? That sort of thing. You can find them everywhere. Okay. How do we represent graphs? Well, there are various ways, but we'll look at two standard ways. One is by means of what's called an adjacency matrix, a very standard representation. And here, just to be compliant with Java speak, I'll index my matrices from 0 up to n minus 1. The standard mathematical indexing would be from 1 up to n. Now, you're mature enough to know that you can switch between the two at will, and it doesn't really matter, as long as you're clear about what indexing you're using. I hope that's clear to everybody, yeah? Okay. So here I'll index them from 0 to n minus 1. I think later on I index them from 1 up to n. Well, what the hell? I mean, come on, you know. Triviality, okay? Absolute triviality. Okay, so we can take our vertices to be the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n minus 1. If the graph has n vertices, you just label them with the integers, okay? And, oh, my apologies. I've got a bit ahead, okay? And then we give ourselves an n by n matrix, okay? And the entry, the ijth entry is 1, if not if there's an edge from vertex I to vertex j. Otherwise, it's 0. Okay? Or you could use a Boolean matrix if you prefer, but it depends on the application, whether you use a matrix with integer entries or Boolean entries. It just very much depends on what you're going to do with this matrix. Okay? But by convention, let's just use 0 and 1. Okay? Very obvious representation. So if we take this example, we get this matrix here. Okay? You notice one possible objection to this kind of representation: most of the entries are zero, and yet we record them explicitly. Okay. Now, we can address that objection by using an alternative data structure called an adjacency list. Okay. Here, we give ourselves a one-dimensional array indexed by the vertices, 0, 1, up to n minus 1. And then off each vertex, we put a list of the vertices to which it has an edge. Okay. So here, this says the vertex 0 has an edge to vertex 2, to vertex 5, and to vertex 4. Okay. So that's not saying that there's an edge from 2 to 5. It's saying the edges from 0 go to 2, go to 5, and go to 4. Clear? Okay. And likewise for the rest of them. Okay. This has the obvious advantage that if there is no edge there, you don't record it. Okay. So if the graph has very few edges, this data structure is going to be significantly smaller than the adjacency matrix. Okay. Quick question to see if you're keeping up with this. Fairly basic stuff. We give ourselves a graph with n vertices, m edges. Now we've got a convention throughout. N is the number of vertices, m is the number of edges of the graph. Okay. Let's denote in V to denote the number of edges going into a vertex, out V the number of edges going out of a vertex. Okay. All right, so with that convention, which structure has the faster, in terms of asymptotics, this is worst case running time for checking if W is adjacent to V? So W and V are two vertices, and I ask you, is there an edge joining one to the other? Okay. Okay. One, adjacency lists. Two, adjacency matrices. Three, they have the same runtime, so it doesn't matter. Or four, it depends on something or other. You all made up your minds? Good man. Okay, there you are. I like somebody who's quick and decisive. And if they're correct, it's even better. But, you know, okay. Well, it's pretty obvious. For the adjacency matrix, it's always theta one time. You just look it up and say, is there one there or is there a zero there? Right? Obvious, right? For adjacency lists, you have to traverse the list hanging off that vertex. And depending on how long that list is, you'll take a corresponding amount of time. Adjacency matrices will always be at least as good as adjacency lists, and if your graph has any number of edges at all, they will be better in terms of this measure. Okay. Now, similar question, but this time, so same setup, but now I want to visit all vertices W adjacent to, adjacent means there's an edge from V to W. Okay. So I'm at vertex V, and I want to visit all the vertices that I can get to by a single edge, starting at V. Okay. So again, same setup. Which is going to be the most efficient? Adjacency list, adjacency matrix. They're the same. Or again, it depends. Duh. Okay. You've all decided. Good. That's my benchmark on the front here. Is decided. Okay. Well. Adjacency matrix, no matter what the situation is, you always need to traverse all the n entries to see if there's an edge or not, right? So you look at the row indexed by vertex V, and you need to go along to see, you know, is there an edge that I can go to or is there not? Okay, you've got to examine them all. Okay, whereas the adjacency list, you merely just traverse along the adjacency list. Okay, so that's going to be proportional to just the number of actual things hanging off this vertex, not the total number of possible vertices that you can visit. Okay, so adjacency list is always going to be at least as good as adjacency matrix, and given that most graphs don't have a lot of edges in the first place, it's going to be better in most cases. Okay, pretty obviously. Okay. So just to sum up the situation here, just a quick little table, which is very easy to understand if you just go through the two representations. In terms of space requirements for storage, and that can be significant because graphs can be absolutely enormous objects. You know, they can run into many, many thousands or hundreds of thousands of vertices. Okay, well, you require always space proportional to n squared for adjacency matrix. So you can see that that's getting bad if n is really very big. Okay, it's getting impractical basically. Otherwise, adjacency list, it's really theta n plus m, because you require n locations to store your vertices, and now for each vertex you have one entry in a list. for each edge, my apologies. Okay, it goes out of one vertex to another vertex, so there's only one entry per edge, so it's proportional to the number of vertices to get your n-dimensional array and the number of edges to get your adjacency lists stored. Okay, so if your graph is relatively sparse in terms of number of edges, that's looking a lot better. Okay, time to check adjacency, we've been through that. The 1 plus there, I remind you, simply because if out V is 0, there's no edge going out, you still require non-zero time to just go there and look and say there's nothing there, okay? Time to visit all the vertices adjacent to something, we've already done that as a quick quiz. Time to visit all the edges of a graph. Well, with the adjacency matrix, you've got to look at the entire matrix because you can't be sure that you've not missed anything out. With the adjacency list, you can traverse the adjacency lists one after the other. Okay, so that's only proportional to n plus m. Okay. Let's just draw a little distinction now, which I won't make very precise, but it's one that you can kind of understand. Given a graph with n vertices and m edges, okay, first of all, m is never going to be bigger than n squared because there are at most n squared pairs of vertices. So there's always that upper bound in the number of edges. Remember, we're not allowing repeated edges, so this is the correct upper bound, okay? And it could be as high as that. You know, you could have a graph of n vertices and you have an edge between every pair of vertices. Okay? However, and if the graph has number of edges basically close to n squared, and I'm not going to define what I mean by close, because really what you mean by that depends on the application at hand, but you can kind of make sense of that idea, I hope, okay? If we're getting close to n squared, we call the graph dense. Okay, for each application area, one has a precise definition of close, but let's leave it at that. Okay. On the other hand, if the graph is really quite far away from n squared, we call it sparse. Okay. You know, for example, if you consider a family of graphs and each member of your family has only log n edges, then by any definition of sparse, the graph is sparse. Okay. That's hardly any edges. Okay. If you want to get a bit more precise. But, you know, the actual definition will depend on the application. Okay? And so, to summarize the preceding observations, if your graph is dense, then adjacency matrices are basically the best choice. If your graph is sparse, then adjacency lists are going to be your best choice. Okay? Now, most graphs in applications are going to be sparse. Because typically, your application is one where the vertices are locations or objects of some kind, and the edges are direct connections between them. Well, you don't have a physical situation where everything is joined to everything else. It just becomes impractical. Right? You have direct connections between some things, and then you go by indirect connections to get to others. Okay? So in most applications, graphs will be sparse. And so in most situations, the adjacency list representation is going to be the one that is most appropriate. I didn't say all of them, notice, okay, most, right? Let's now look at the fundamental problem we wish to address, which is we're given a graph and we want to traverse it. What does that mean? It means we want to visit all the vertices of the graph, but respecting presence or absence of edges. You can only go from one vertex to another if there is an edge joining them in that direction. Okay. You can't just jump around arbitrarily. The reason for this is because you're exploring some property of the graph which corresponds to some underlying property of the thing you're representing. Okay, if you think of a graph like, you know, the one group of all people, friends, and if you consider that if person A is a friend of person B and B is a friend of person C, then A and C are also somehow friends, then traversing the graph is starting at somebody and saying, okay, who are all the friends in this kind of transitive closure idea? Friends of friends, friends of friends of friends, and so on. Okay, you're traversing the graph respecting edges. If there's no edge there, then there's no friendship there. Okay, that's the kind of idea that we're modeling here. Okay, and we have basically two ways of traversing a graph: BFS, which stands for breadth first search, and DFS, which stands for depth first search. Both of these are ways that are used to traverse a graph. They have various good and bad points. Okay, the general strategy is as follows. For both of these ideas, okay, pick an arbitrary vertex V of the graph to start from somewhere. Okay, now visit all the vertices reachable from V, and whenever you visit a vertex, mark it in some way or other, saying I've seen this, okay. So you know you visited it. Okay. When you finish traversing all reachable vertices from V, go back and see if there are any vertices you have not yet visited. And choose one that hasn't been visited, and repeat until everything's been seen. That's the general strategy. Okay. The details are what distinguish between the two methods here. Okay. So BFS has the following strategy. Okay. We pick our vertex V, and now we visit all the immediate neighbors of V, okay, one after the other. When you've done that, you now look at those and visit their neighbors, one after the other, and then their neighbors, and so on. Each time marking thing as, something as being seen. If you've seen it, you don't go to it again. Okay. So basically, you're visiting, first of all vertices reachable by a path of length 1, then all those reachable by a path of length 2, then length 3, then length 4, and so on. Okay. So you're examining as much as you can before going to any longer path. That's why it's called breadth-first search. Okay. Let's have a look at... look at the pseudocode for this and then look at an example, okay? So the BFS top-level algorithm is very simple. We initialize a Boolean array, let's call it visited, indexed by vertices, so we can mark a vertex as being visited or not, okay? And we initialize all entries to be false, first of all, because we've not seen any vertex yet, okay? And now we initialize a queue, which will keep for us the vertices that are to be examined, okay? That we've encountered, okay? And now we go cycle through all the vertices of our graph, V, okay? If a vertex has not been visited, then we initialize a BFS from that vertex, okay? This BFS will itself mark vertices as being visited, okay? So that this loop here is not necessarily going to call this for every vertex, because this call here updates this array for us, okay? So when this call finishes, it will typically have marked quite a lot of vertices having been seen through this call, so that this loop would just skip over them. Okay. So the distinctive point about this is this call here. Okay. DFS has the same structure, but it calls a different thing here. Okay. Well, what does this do? Well, when you call BFS, the first thing you do is mark the vertex from which you called as being visited. Okay. And now you put the vertex onto the queue to say, this is the one I've got to examine, okay? If you like, maybe visitor is not the right word for it, but anyway, let's stick with that, okay? And now, while the queue is not empty, there's something there left for you to do, okay? This represents the agenda you've got to do for this vertex, okay? You take a vertex off the queue, look at all of its neighbors in turn. If they've not been visited yet, you put them onto the queue. And you keep doing this, all right? When the queue becomes empty, there's nothing left for you to examine, so you've finished as regards what's reachable from this vertex, okay? Let's try and understand this by a simple example, okay? Let's take this one here, okay? Here's a bit of chalk. Let's get rid of that there. So rather than going into a general explanation of the algorithm, let's just do a simple example which will illustrate for you what's going on, okay? So, I went too far. Okay, we have our queue, let me call it queue, okay? And I've got my array of vertices, 0, 1 up to 6. Let me put it over here, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay? When I visit it, I'll just cross it out, okay? And I'll underline it to show you where I am in the loop, okay? So I start off here, okay? And I'll call BFS from 0, and it says mark it as visited, put it on the queue, okay? And call, you know, we've called the process, you know, BFS from 0, okay? And now it says, okay, get the first vertex off the queue. It's a first in, first out thing, okay? So that comes off. The queue is now empty, but it says, look at its neighbors, okay? And if they're not visited yet, put them on the queue, okay? Well, what are the neighbors of 0? Well, for example, 4 is a neighbor, okay? is not yet visited, so put it on the queue, okay, and mark it as being seen. Okay, so any more neighbors? Well, two is a neighbor. Not yet seen, so put it on, okay? Any more neighbors? Well, five is a neighbor. Okay. Has it been seen yet? No. Put it on the queue. Any more neighbors? I don't think so. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm quite loud to me. Okay, yeah? So what we put now is put all the vertices reachable directly from zero by one edge. Yes? Okay? The loop says, is the queue empty? Doesn't look like it to me, right? Pull the first vertex off the queue, so now it becomes becomes two and five. Look at all the neighbors of the vertex you just pulled off, and look at them, at its neighbors, okay? Well, four, what are the neighbors of four? Zero is a neighbor, okay? But it's been seen, so we just ignore it, okay? We don't do anything with it, okay? Five is a neighbor of four. It's been seen, so nothing. Any more neighbors of four? No. So that's that dealt with. The loop goes back to the start, is the queue empty? No. Pull the first vertex off it. So that's going to be left with five. We'll pull two off, and the queue now just has five on it. Look at the neighbors of two. What are the neighbors of two? Well, five is a neighbor, but it's been seen. One is a neighbor. Has it been seen? No. So mark it and put it at the back of the queue. It's a first in, first out, so it goes at the back. Okay. That's how you maintain the breadth first property. You know, the later you're seen, the later you're going to be examined. Okay. All right. Any more neighbors? No. So we've done two. Yeah. I forgot we've done five. Okay. Go back to the start of the loop. Is the queue empty? No. So pull the first vertex off the queue. That's five. You're left with one on the queue. Look at the neighbors of five in turn. Five is a very lonely vertex. Well, no, it's actually not very lonely. It's got lots of things looking at it, but it doesn't want to look at anything. So it has no neighbors at all, so we immediately finish with five. Okay. Queue is not empty. Pull one off it. So the queue is now empty, but we might put stuff on it, of course. You know, we haven't finished. What to examine one? What are the neighbors of one? Well, one has zero as a neighbor, but zero has been seen. No more neighbors, so that's finished. The queue is now empty. Okay. So BFS from the original vertex zero has now finished. Right? Clear? Our loop now moves on to here. It says, have you been visited? Yes, so nothing to do. Now it moves on to here. This is the outer loop, remember. Have you been visited? Yes, nothing to do. It now moves on to three. Have you been visited? No, so something to do. Mark it as visited. And now your queue gets three put onto it, okay? We've called BFS from three, goes on the queue, okay? Pull it off the queue. What are the neighbors of three? Well, one is a neighbor, but one has been seen. Okay, so now you do. Any more neighbors? Six is a neighbor. Okay, have we seen it before? Nope. So we mark it and put it on the queue. Any more neighbors of three? No, so that's finished. Is the queue empty? No. Okay, pull that off. Look at the neighbors of six, and they've all been visited, of course. So now it finishes. Clear? It's as simple as that, okay? So, but this strategy of putting first in, first out automatically gives us the breadth first property, if you think about it. Okay. It's a very simple idea, but you know, so what? Just as well, because it's a very fundamental algorithm. Okay. All right, quick question. If I give you a graph with n vertices, m edges, what's the worst case running time of BFS in terms of m and n? We've got two parameters here, so let's just keep them like that, okay? is it theta of m plus n, theta of n squared, theta of mn, or depends on the number of components of the graph, if you know what that is. What is the runtime, do you reckon? I'm waiting for my front row here. Okay, you've decided. Well, it's one if you use an adjacency list representation. So it's a bit of a cheat question, actually. I didn't tell you which data structure I'm using, okay? But if you use adjacency list representation and you do your counting carefully, it's theta of m plus n. Okay. If you use adjacency matrix representation, then it's going to be theta n squared, necessary, because you've got to look at everything, okay, to examine, you know, you've got to visit every entry of the matrix to make sure you've seen all the necessary edges, okay? All right. I don't want to dwell on that now. I just want to leave that aside for now. We want to DFS, okay? The idea here is similar, but we use a different ordering strategy for how we visit things. We start at our vertex V as usual. We choose a vertex V from which to start. We maintain a list of if we visited something or not, just as before. Obviously, that's necessary to avoid infinite loops of just going round and round the same vertices, okay? And now we pick a neighbor of V, visit that, okay? And now we look if that neighbor has any neighbors not yet visited. And if it has, we pick one of those and visit that, and so on, until we can't visit any more, and then we backtrack to the previous vertex and look if it has any neighbors left that we can visit, okay? And so on. Okay, so we're going as deep as possible in the graph before we say, is there any alternative? In the breadth first, we're looking at everything at level one, level two, level three. This is just saying, no, keep going further and further away until you can't go any further away, and now backtrack to one level up, and so on, okay? Hence the name depth first search, okay? Breadth first, you favor exploring the breadth of the graph. Depth, you go as deep as you can in terms of path length, okay? All right, let's look at how to implement this. In fact, what's remarkable about these two fundamental search methods is that they're essentially the same except for the queuing discipline. Okay, for breadth first, you're using a first-in, first-out queue. For depth first, you're using a first-in, last-out queue. In other words, a stack. Otherwise, the algorithms are identical. Okay, this loop is exactly the same as before, except for this call to DFS from vertex rather than BFS. And DFS just says, do as what I did before, but put things on a stack. Use a stack discipline instead of a queue discipline. Okay? And that will ensure depth first search if you think about it a little bit. Right? Why? Because if I'm here, I look at the neighbors, but I favor the one I pull off is the one I put on before, and then I do that. And only when I finish that do I go and push this onto the stack. Yeah. Okay. Best way to understand why this works so well, do the example I did, but for this case. Okay? I'll leave you to do that at home. It's a very good way of understanding why a stack discipline is going to give you what you want. Okay? It's quite a simple idea, but it's a beautiful idea. Okay. Now, we can actually represent this method without an explicit stack, just using recursive algorithm, okay? But if you think about it, so this recursive bit here, all we're doing is using the implicit stack that you use when you implement recursion instead of an explicit stack that we build ourselves. Okay. This is exactly the same algorithm, really. Is that clear to everybody? Yeah? Basic, simple idea. So in terms of denoting the algorithm, this is easier to grasp. In terms of efficiency, you might well want to implement your own stack because you have more control over that rather than letting the system do it. But they are the same algorithm. Okay? Yeah? Okay. So what's the runtime? Oh, brilliant. I'm way ahead of myself. That's good. What's the runtime of DFS? Okay. It looks horrendous to analyze. Okay? Whichever version you take, whether you take the recursive version or this explicit loop version, they're the same algorithm after all. And it looks like it's going to be pretty horrible because you've got this outer loop to account for. Okay, But it doesn't, if you say, oh, that's N executions, that looks like it's, you know, overestimated by a long way, because whenever you call this thing here, you're going to mark quite a lot of vertices, aren't you? So you're not going to get to execute every single one of these calls, right? So if you say it's N calls of DFS from vertex GB, that looks like a severe overestimate, and indeed it is, right? And then you get into this, and you say, well, how on earth am I going to handle all these, you know, if visited is true, do this, otherwise, ah. It looks horrible, does it not? Am I making a good job of making it look horrible? Oh, go on, nod, come on. Remember, you're not allowed to be miserable. I'm the miserable one, right? Yeah? You're meant to be happy and knowledgeable. I'm the ignorant one. Anyway, it looks horrible, right? This is where a little bit of thought goes a long way, as so often, okay? If instead of trying to do it by recurrences and so on, which really are not appropriate here, okay, because of the nature of the algorithm, there's too much cross-interference between this call here, you see, and this loop here. Okay, so if you do a recurrence, it's very simple-minded, it overestimates by a hell of a long way. Okay. But if you think about the following, each vertex of the graph, okay, what happens to it? It gets marked as visited exactly once, right? And it never gets unmarked. Okay, so once you mark as visited, that's it. Okay. When do you ever do any work from a vertex? Just after you've marked it as visited, right? Yeah. So if you account for the work you do just after you mark each vertex as visited, sum it all up over all the vertices, that's the total amount of work you've done in the search. Okay? All right. So how much work do we do as soon as we mark a vertex visited? Well, here it is. You look at all its adjacent matrices, and vertices, and stick them onto the stack. Right? That accounts for the work you do for that particular vertex. Yeah? And then you make a call for each vertex off the stack, that's the work for that vertex when you pull it off. Right? So just count for the immediate cost of, we were at this vertex, we do something, and now we pass off to other vertices. So accounting for what we do immediately for each vertex. Well, the total cost there is, well, I've got it on this slide, okay? It's theta of 1 plus the out degree of V, the number of edges going out of it, because that's what you examine. It's 1 plus because if the out degree is 0, you still do at least some work to say, you know, nothing to do here. Okay? That's just that little technicality about, you know, if you pass something that's empty, you still need to check that it's empty. So it doesn't cost you 0 amount, it costs you some amount to do it. Okay? But that's the cost that this does on account of this vertex just now, and then it passes it off to another call. Okay? And DFSG goes through the array, this one here, one after the other. Okay. So its cost is theta n plus then the cost to each of the vertices that we're spreading around in our accounting. Okay. So the overall work we do is theta of n for these. And again, you should say, hang on a minute, what if n is zero? Okay, you're saying it's zero cost, but it does take you at least some time to check. Okay, if n is zero, the graph has no vertices and no edges. Okay, so I think we'll just leave that as an exception. Say we never consider the empty graph. Okay, if n is zero, there's nothing there. It's the empty graph. So we'll just kind of say, oh, you know, to hell with it. Okay, strictly speaking, I should have written theta of 1 plus n. Okay, but basically that's just, you know, noise. Okay, whereas, you know, a non-empty graph, you can still have no edges going out of a given vertex. That's not such a triviality. Okay, so that's why I'm being more careful here than here. Okay, yeah. So my total cost is the theta of n that accounts for the looping around this array. Okay. Then the cost of work that each vertex does immediately is theta of 1 plus the out degree of that from that vertex. Okay. Well, theta of n plus the sum of these thetas is a simple exercise to show that that's the same as theta of n plus this sum here. Okay, a straightforward exercise to do that. Okay, well, the one here is being added to itself how many times? Well, as many times as there are vertices, that's just n. So this one here accounts for an n. Okay, so that's theta of n plus n. And then we've got sum of v in v, or out degree of v. What does that sum equal to? That looks horrendous, but it isn't really. If you think about it, each edge goes out of exactly one vertex, right? By definition of graphs, right? So if I go through the vertices and count how many edges go out of each vertex, how many edges have I counted? Just the number of edges. You don't count any edge twice. You count every edge exactly once. Right? You do see it once, and you don't see it twice. So this sum here, although it looks horrendous, is actually just the number of edges of the graph, which is m. Okay? So it's theta of n plus n plus m. Theta of 2n plus m is just the same as theta of n plus m. Right? Just take out the constants. Okay? So although it looked horrendous to analyze the runtime, it's actually pretty simple if one thinks of it in this kind of spread around way of accounting for how much work you do here, here, and here. Okay? Simply because if you do it the other way, the way that we're doing it before, there's too much cross interference between the subroutine and the calling routine. Okay? And you would end up with a terrible overestimate. If you do it, you'll find that you have an extra factor of n, basically, which is way too much. Okay? So that's brilliant. I've left myself a bit of time. Last time I prepared a little demo, I thought this will be good, they'll like this, and I forgot to show it to you. This has gone back to Quicksort, so I might as well show it to you now as a little encore. We'll do more on graphs next time. Let me just show you this little demo about Quicksort, because it was just to show you the practicalities of it. Okay, so where is it? Oh, here it is. Okay, now, so I remind you that Quicksort has a worst case running time of proportional to n squared, n being the number of items. But I said that, typically it's much better than that in practice, because if you just run it on a random array, the chances of getting bad splits are pretty low, and they tend to get, swamped by the fact that you tend to get good splits most of the time. So its typical performance is more like n log n than n squared, okay? So what I did here was to implement Quicksort following the pseudocode of the nodes exactly, okay? Only allowing that in this system, array starts at 1 instead of 0, which is a minor difference, but that's the same algorithm, okay? And then I run tests from 500 tests, generating an array at random with entries between minus 100 and 100, and in steps of 10. So there are 500 arrays of size 1, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, up to 5,000. Okay? And then keep the runtimes. In this language, if I say garbage collect, it listens to me and it garbage collects. Okay? Isn't that nice? Sensible. Yeah. Okay. I make no further comment. Okay? So I'll garbage collect before calling every time. That means that every call has the same initial conditions. Okay, so the runtimes are genuinely reliable. And here's the plot, and you can see, although of course there's going to be noise up and down, I've only done one experiment per size, but you can see that this runtime doesn't look as horrendous as an n-squared type runtime. It looks rather better than that. I would need to do much more data for us to get an idea, but it's kind of n log n type performance, to be fair to it. There will be ups and downs, of course, because we won't always get a favorable split every time. Okay, but overall, you can see how the runtime is just pretty good. I also commented on the fact that on a typical array, when you follow the splits that happen, they are generally very favorable to you. Okay, you're unlikely to get a bad split. So an experiment now which generates arrays of size 1,000, again, entries being uniformly at random from minus 100 to 100, and we're doing 500 experiments. Okay? So that's 500 calls and on arrays of size 1,000 randomly generated. Okay? And we're keeping the runtime for each such call. Again, garbage collecting every time. Okay? And then plot the histogram of those runtimes. Now, so there are 500 data items here, but if you plot the histogram, there it is. Okay? You've only got a few bins in this histogram, okay? And notice the runtimes are going from 0.032 to 0.036. So even as one bin, that's not a huge spread of runtime, okay? But in fact, within the sort of margin of width of the bins, we've only got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these, and the central one is by far the biggest. So the overwhelming majority of the arrays have a runtime around that central part. Okay, and if one can justify this by theoretical analysis, that shows that, you know, if you consider all the possible arrays and you consider the possible splits, the overwhelming majority cluster around one kind of runtime, which is n log n. Okay. So that's the kind of experimental version of a theoretical analysis. Okay. This doesn't prove it, it just kind of shows us that there's something interesting going on with quicksort in terms of its behavior on the average. Okay, I hope that was interesting. It's filled up the time nicely, 5 minutes early. Let's give ourselves 5 minutes rest. See you next time. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I haven't.
Perfect. Is that okay to leave it on?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That's great.
I hope so.
I think it goes off after a while.
Oh, that's all right. We'll be in 2 seconds. Move a couple of these out and put them together. Don't just hand out PhDs in Alexandria, you've got to be able to do stuff at the table together. Should I just leave these on paper now?
Just normal water.
Oh, that's fine. Just ordinary, non-sparkling, if
possible. Sorry, I thought you were talking about the bag. No, the gloves aren't mine. Yeah. Someone come to it.
Do you need two screens?
Why not?
It's interesting.
It would have been perfect if we had known this enough in advance to have said, okay, let's just kind of do a joint presentation, because we've done this before. We've done this at the Sakharov conference in London. That would have been kind of...
Yeah, I could have. It's a very busy weekend for me, and I'm going to London on Saturday.
Did you stand out for the weekend?
Yeah, because yesterday was my daughter's 25th birthday.
Oh.
So she's in London, so I think it's the afternoon. So then I need to visit kind of family, and on Sunday we're meeting my son for French.
Oh, yeah.
Because unfortunately he can't come to Saffron because it's his fifth wedding anniversary.
Oh.
So he's busy.
Not a bad excuse.
So it's complicated. But you could just put this, you know, here.
Okay.
Going okay? I literally would not know where to start with something like this.
I'm not very happy with the DVD player.
It says Discara.
How is that? Wait a second, did you... wait a moment, if it's projected...
Wait.
Ah, you would try through the computer, okay, that's a good idea. Is it a British disc?
So yes, of course it is, it's an artificial iDisc.
In this case it should be fine.
Okay, so we need...
Oh, yes, yes, I will... Doesn't allow me to type the username here. Did we put it on the mode of computer? PC?
No, it's on PC. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's it. Okay. For some reason,
it
doesn't allow
me
to do it. Okay, no. Oh, it should be. Okay, I've understood. I have to wait on screen.